working to prevent suicide in Maine. 16 years ago, the Maine Centers for Disease Control, along with many other agencies and organizations, founded the Maine Suicide Prevention Program. They aim to take a comprehensive approach to stemming suicide in the state. Despite years of effort, Maine's overall suicide rate remains higher than the national average. There are 14 suicides here for every 100,000 people. The national average is 12.4. Every suicide is devastating for family and friends, and experts believe most, if not all, are preventable. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll learn more about preventing suicide. What are the warning signs? What steps can people take if they suspect someone is considering ending his or her life? And what resources are available for help? Mental health professionals believe that many myths and misperceptions still abound. Maine Calling looks at suicide prevention and where to turn for help. But first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in Maine, affecting people of all ages and backgrounds. Today, we'll hear from experts on what the state is doing to help prevent suicide and what all of us should know. With me in the studio, Seth Mativier. He is the manager of the Crisis Line at Opportunity Alliance. He is also a clinician working in community mental health and private practice. Joining us from our Augusta studio, Dr. Sheila Panette, director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and Greg Marley, clinical director with NAMI Maine. NAMI stands for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We invite you to join our conversation. What questions do you have about how to best help someone considering suicide? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today on this really important, although tough, program. And Dr. Panette, I'd like to start with you. I have read that suicide knows no gender, class, or age boundaries, but still there are groups of people at greater risk. What can you tell us about the risk factors for suicide?
Well, there's many risk factors. There's family risk factors, a history of suicide in the family, or there's been a family structure change, such as a death, divorce. There can be behavioral risk factors, such as school failure or truancy, alcoholic or drug abuse, and environmental risk factors, exposure to suicide from other peers, or high levels of stress or pressure or social isolation. And pretty much it could be related to mental health, psychiatric conditions such as depression or anxiety or bipolar illness. And people can have problems with impulse control, feeling powerless or hopeless, helpless.
That embodies a lot of people, a lot of risks you've just enumerated.
That's right. You know, suicide's actually a rare event, but it can occur across all ages, races, faith, culture, economic lifestyles. And, you know, the most important thing is for us to continue to talk about it and not to believe that when you talk about it that it causes suicide, because it does not cause suicide. It's important for us to help people understand the risk and how we can get help for one another.
Well, that's a perfect segue. Steve, I was going to ask you, what are the warning signs of suicide?
Well, some of the warning signs that we look for are increased isolation, feeling like a sense of burden, if somebody's increasing their substance use, lack of connection with others, and others are noticing that maybe their friends or family are pulling away. Certainly, when we hear individuals talking about suicidal ideation, or putting out expressions of the idea of wanting to end their life, that's definitely an alarming warning sign.
What is suicidal ideation? Is that what you said, idealization or ideation?
Suicidal ideation would be ideas about ending one's life. So in the crisis services, we look to explore what those thoughts are that are going through an individual's mind. Is there a plan? Are they thinking about specific ways that they would like to end their life? Or they're actually thinking about that. Is there a plan and intent to do that? Have they gathered means? So those are some of the things that we look at for warning signs of actually taking an attempt on ending one's life.
Okay. Greg, Maine has a higher rate of suicide than the national average. Do we know why?
Well, Across the country, areas that are rural tend to be have higher suicide rates. The highest rates in the country are in the kind of western mountain states, Alaska, Montana, Wyoming. And Maine shares in common that sense of isolation, isolation of individuals from social supports, isolation from professional intervention, and also along with rurality comes higher gun ownership. And there's a definite connection between firearm access and lethality in suicide.
Jennifer, I think, you know, we have all pointed out that there are warning signs, and it's very important. The literature demonstrates to us that over 80% of deaths by suicide have some associated warning sign associated with them. So it's our role and our goal to help educate the public on what these warning signs are so that they know how to get help.
It sounded as though many of the things that Steve said are also warning signs for depression. And I'm wondering how someone differentiates between someone who's feeling blue, someone who might be clinically depressed, and someone who might be thinking of suicide. Steve?
Well, I think it's, you know, it starts with a conversation. We look to explore what it is that's going on. If you notice a friend or family that seems down, seems to be acting different than what you know them to be acting, asking them and exploring what might be going on for them, or to figure out, is this a real depression or are they just having a sad day? And oftentimes we look to see if this is just on a snapshot or is this something that we're seeing over a period of time.
Will people be honest if they're asked by family or friends?
Mm-hmm. Generally they are, but there certainly are individuals that aren't honest. So that's a challenging area that I think is part of why we're brought here today to talk about this. It's, you know, suicide prevention is not one individual or one entity's responsibility. It's something that we all need to play a part in.
Greg, Go ahead.
One of the things, the hallmarks we rest upon is that the reality is the vast majority of people who are suicidal tell at least one other person before they ever take action against their life. And that's what suicide prevention rests upon, to take those kinds of comments seriously, to follow up and to ask somebody. You know, we talk about depression, and depression is strongly connected with suicide, and yet, you know, there's 16 million people diagnosed with depression in America in a given year. Very, very tiny percentage of those ever are suicidal. So depression is related to suicidal thoughts, but not suicidal action.
Sheila, I understand that suicide has actually gone up recently in Maine. Do we know why? Do we believe if it's linked to the recession, or is there something else going on?
We're not exactly sure why, but we do know that increased isolation does bring about thoughts or feelings of suicide. And, you know, there is some question about victimization, bullying, and cyberbullying. And, you know, we don't have research that demonstrates direct cause and effect, but we do believe that there is a correlation with that.
Okay. And Seth, if someone is listening and is worried about a loved one or even a friend, and I suspect there are people out there right now, what should they do?
My first answer to that is definitely just to call the crisis line. I think there's a lot of hesitation for people to call crisis and to dial that number. But if you have any hesitation at all and you're wondering or worried about anybody, yourself or a loved one, to dial 1-888-568-1112. That is the statewide crisis line, and it will direct you to the crisis call specialists that are in a center nearest to you, anywhere in the state of Maine.
I'm going to have you repeat that number in just a second, but if someone is, for example, in their car and not able to, it doesn't have a pen right now, if you call 211, you can also figure out how to get a hold of the crisis line as well, right?
Yeah, certainly 211 is an easier number to remember, so if you call them, they can get you in touch with us very easily.
But can you repeat the crisis line number for us now?
I can. It's 1-888-568-1112. And again, that's the number to call if you're worried about anybody, yourself, somebody else, and you're just wanting to explore and help to evaluate what the best response is.
Greg, Dr. Panette mentioned bullying very briefly. Can you talk about youth suicide, and is there a connection between this increase in bullying and cyberbullying and youth suicide?
We want to be really clear that bullying doesn't cause suicide. If you have a room of 50 people, adults or youth, and you ask how many of you have been bullied, the majority of them will raise their hand, and yet they're all alive. So bullying is a risk factor. It makes someone more vulnerable. And if you're bullying, if you're harassed, and that's about who you are, it is really destabilizing. But suicide is complicated. So the vast majority of people who are bullied, who are harassed, do not attempt or die by suicide. And yet it's a strong risk factor, and we're concerned about it. And we're concerned even more today because 30 years ago, you could go home and escape most of the bullying. Today, with the cyberbullying, the use of social media, it's almost impossible to escape it. And that's something we're quite aware of and concerned about.
Jennifer, I think it's important to underline what Greg's just pointed out, and that is that risk factors do not cause suicide. But when we have these factors all colliding with one another, it can increase an individual's vulnerability. But oftentimes it's multiple things at once, external stresses, internal conflict, and you can have some neurobiologic dysfunction or mental health at the same time.
Greg, I wanted to talk about some myths and misperceptions. I suspect all of you would like to weigh in on this. What kind of attitudes and beliefs are still out there that you believe hurt suicide prevention efforts?
Well, one of the things that in the trainings we do with the Maine Suicide Prevention Program is we invite people to be comfortable talking about suicide. Suicide remains stigmatized, it remains a taboo, and we're afraid to even use the word or words to equate to suicide. So one of the pieces is, yes, if you're concerned about someone, call crisis, but also ask them. Most people who are suicidal are driven by a need to stop the pain they're feeling, to find some relief. And that sense of isolation and breaking it by asking and inviting the conversation is huge. So that, to me, and when we're talking about everybody, that is one of the biggest things that people can do. And it's one of the myths that we have is if you talk about suicide, you plant the idea. And the other one is that people who talk about suicide, if you're making those statements, making those threats, yeah, you're not serious, you're not actually going to die. But the reality is we must take any of those statements seriously. There are estimated to be at least 100 suicide attempts in young people for every death. And for those young people, a minor attempt at suicide is a huge and strident cry for help. And if they get the resources, the support, they learn new skills, they reduce the stresses in their life, the vast majority of them never go back to another suicidal crisis. We must respond.
Would you like to add to that, Seth? What do you? I know that you work with youths a great deal. What other myths and what misperceptions are there, especially about teen suicide and teens' attitudes toward it?
I think just to highlight again on what Greg had said, that bullying is certainly huge in the schools right now, and that does not equal that one is going to die by suicide. The other piece that Greg had added about just asking somebody if they are suicidal is not going to put that idea in their mind. In fact, what we see both in crisis and also what I see in outpatient, as well as what I have witnessed from others asking friends and family directly, are they suicidal, that it almost provides a level of comfort in the conversation to discuss what it is that's bothering them.
Mm. How difficult is it for teenagers to try to help a friend? You know, I know that I have two of them. I know that they don't want to be tattletales. They don't want to turn to adults often. They want to try to figure things out themselves. What do we say to teens to make it clear that this is really important, that if they're worried about a friend, they need to say something right away to an adult?
I think that's really important. Excuse me.
That's all right,
because kids today really have this sense of privacy and protecting their mm-hmm. friends and not being a snitch. And, you know, I have five children myself, and I always struggle with that. And I encourage them, if you don't want to tell me, then make sure you find a trusted adult, and particularly a teacher or somebody in their religious community, or just know how to get help and to call 211. And as you know, LD 609 was signed into legislation in April of 2013, unanimously voted voted by the legislature and immediately signed by our governor, Governor Paul LePage, to make sure that all people who have access to our children in the school system will be educated about suicide risk and know how to get help for children that they may identify that are at risk. And that was probably one of the biggest things that we've done for our children in the past year.
So all teachers, all people who work in the schools will be receiving training that they didn't have before?
That's correct. It means the bus driver. It means the janitors. It means the lunch ladies. Anybody and everybody that has access to our children will now be educated in the state of Maine about suicide and their risk.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have your comments and questions. Stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Sweetser, serving mental and behavioral health needs of children, adults, and families in Maine since 1828. Sweetser.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This letter landed its writer a job in Hollywood.
Dear sir, I like words. I like fat, buttery words such as ooze.
It's part of a new collection of unusually well-written letters from history.
I like spurious, black-is-white words such as mortician.
Letters to employers, to lovers, to a rocket scientist. A British blogger uncovers letters of note next time on The World.
Join us for The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock. May is Life is Better Month here at MPBN. You count on MPBN for so many reasons, and MPBN counts on you. If you make a donation to MPBN during May, you'll be automatically entered into our Life is Better contest with a first place prize this year of a new Nissan Juke S donated by Lee Auto Mall. We have two second place prizes of a summer weekend getaway for four with golf at Sugarloaf. No purchase is necessary, void where prohibited. Full contest rules are at mpbn.net. Just click on support. May is Life is Better with MPBN Month.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what Maine is doing to prevent suicide and what we should all know. With me in the studio, Seth Mativier. He is manager of the Crisis Line at Opportunity Alliance and a clinician. Joining us from our Augusta studio, Dr. Sheila Panette, director of the Maine CDC, and Greg Marley, clinical director with NAMI Maine. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Opening the lines now and going to Thomas in Lewiston. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a firm believer in cause and effect. Most of the things that happen in this world around us, something causes in some way or another for these things to happen. Now, yes, there are some instances of bullying, but I think we're giving too much time to the bullying epidemic. I think what's causing a lot of suicide is, and basically what does drive people to suicide is hopelessness. For the most part, it's hopelessness. For the most part. And a state of hopelessness exists in America today like no other time. We're living in a place and a time where politicians are not working in our best interests. Most politicians are stealing. They're in bed with the military-industrial complex, constantly starting conflict around the world. Our environment is falling apart. The bankers are getting bailed out, while hardworking folks are getting thrown out of their houses.
Okay, Thomas, I think I understand your point. Seth, I'm going to let you address that. Do you find that? Do you find this sense of sort of hopelessness with the situation, that people feel as though the world is rigged against them and this is what's leading to suicidal thoughts?
That certainly is a large part of what we experience on the crisis line. We do have individuals that are dealing with an episodic crisis, and we help them address what's leading them to that, and we're successfully able to really help them through that. There are individuals that we're supporting on a fairly regular basis that are dealing with some prolonged hopelessness and clinical depression and things of what you're discussing here, Thomas. In terms of cause and effect, I understand where you're coming from, and the supports that are out there are geared towards trying to help people work through those things and avoid ending their life by depression, by suicide. Sorry.
All right. Go ahead, Sheila. And David, if you could hold on just a minute. Go ahead, Dr. Panette.
Thomas, I just wanted to say I certainly hear you in that, you know, there are a lot of risk factors, and sometimes they can become overwhelming. And it's very important to make sure that individuals who feel at risk and hopeless, that they do enter into a engagement with their primary care provider or their counselors to help guide them and help them learn to cope and deal with the issues that they find conflict with in their life.
Going to David in Portland. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi there. Well, it's interesting that Thomas brought up, you touched on what I would like to mention, that sense of hopelessness is going from macro to micro and vice versa. I've been in human services for about 20 years. I work primarily with at-risk youth on all levels. And that sense of nothingness and that no matter what you do, you're not going to win the game is prevalent, especially in Maine. I grew up in central Maine on a farm and, you know, a regional high school where we lost at least one or two kids in the span of 4 years.
David, can you speak closer to your receiver? We're having a hard time hearing you.
Hello? Can you hear me now?
It's a little better. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. So I grew up in central Maine, and I actually, in the last year, a very close friend of my brother's son and daughter, both under the age of 20, took their own lives, and it was a result of bullying with the younger one. And I actually didn't understand that, and you obviously know this, that if you lose a sibling, then your chance of taking your own in that choice quadruples, you know, 500% or something. So anyway, Maine propagates because I think we're isolated by nature, and it's a do-it-yourself and or leave-me-alone kind of environment. Up here, if you get closer to urbanity and culture, people lean on each other a little more openly. And I think New England has a stigma of keeping things quiet. So.
Greg, would you like to address David's comments?
Well, both David and Thomas talked about situations that increase the stress in someone's life. And we are living in an increasingly complex and more stressful world. That challenge our coping skills and challenge our ability to manage what's going on. The economic stresses and the loss of jobs, particularly among people who are less educated and flexible, is incredible stress. So all of that hopelessness that is a reflection of people who are isolated, disconnected, and unable to cope with the world. And I think that our challenge in prevention is to reach out and offer people hope, offer people alternatives, and to increase for our young people how they're able to cope with the stresses in their life. And that struggle with coping is reflected in a lot of behaviors that we're seeing increasing in young people.
And would you say that David's numbers are accurate, that if a sibling has contemplated suicide or followed through with it, that it is your chances are four times greater that you're at risk?
I certainly would not put a number on that. We know that the risk of suicide is increased significantly if someone in your family has died by suicide, who's chosen that path. It's not genetic, but it's behavioral as a risk factor. And so if it's a parent, the sibling risk or the youth risk that for their children increase, it certainly runs in families. And my family is very much living with that.
All right, David, thanks for your call. Going to Jane. And Jane, are you calling from Orrinville?
Yes.
Cornville.
Orrinville.
Wow, where is Orrinville?
It's north of Bangor.
All right. Well, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
I just wanted to add my two cents. I've been working in mental health in inpatient and outpatient psychiatric services, and the helplessness and hopelessness definitely have been signs and symptoms. And again, the history of family or friends who have committed or even attempted suicide. But what's really interesting to me is some of the recent research over the last couple of decades, actually where I worked at McLean Hospital, part of the Mass General system, is looking at brain structure. Functional MRIs and PET-CETs have shown that actual structures in the brain have changes in mid-adolescence in particular. And the symptoms from that are a decreased impulsivity, impulsive containment, and also increased poor judgment. Of course, this is when we give them a driver's license at 16, and that's pretty scary. And then things, the brain networks and so forth, seem to change and develop a maturity after that mid-adolescent period. But one thing I thought was real helpful for people who need to watch out for it is an acronym that they use at Harvard Med School with the residents, and that's SIGACAP. S stands for change in sleep, I for a lack of interest in things that usually gave you pleasure, G is for a increase of feeling guilty, E is for change in energy. Usually it's slowing down, but it also could be increasing, like pacing. C is for change in concentration. Usually, I mean, less of that. A is for appetite. Either an increase, a sudden increase that's appreciable, or a decrease. Many seriously depressed people don't eat. And P is for psychomotor changes. That means movement. If you feel like you're filled with lead and can hardly get out of bed, or you walk like you're walking through Jell-O, I'd say. And the S is for the suicidal ideation, obsessing about dying, obsessing about wishing you were dead. And as was spoken before, a history of family or friends who have attempted or committed suicide. We hear a lot about adolescents who broke up with a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and that seems to be a very critical time for suicide. And also, I've seen a lot of middle-aged men who suddenly lost their job when they were the breadwinner for their family, and the job was their identity and purpose. And if they lost the job, feeling they could no longer take care of their family.
And these sound like the stressors that Greg was talking about. Seth, are the symptoms that you are hearing Jane talk about, is this pretty much what you experience in your practice as well?
Yeah, very much so.
All right. Well, Jane, thanks so much for your call. Going to Susan in Old Orchard. Go ahead, Susan.
Hi there. I was wondering if you call the crisis line for yourself or for somebody else, if your number is kept confidential, can you feel safe just feeling out what kind of help is available, or will a professional automatically be on your doorstep?
No, absolutely. And that's one of the common myths that are out there in terms of crisis services, is that if you call a crisis line that either a crisis worker or the police department is going to show up, and that is definitely a myth. We encourage people to call, and there is the option of remaining anonymous, so we're not going to try and track down your number and find out who you are. We really want to get resources and supportive information out there to people. Certainly, if somebody is at risk, we are going to work towards trying to help that individual, but the idea you raise of somebody showing up on your doorstep is absolutely not going to take place.
All right, Susan, good question. Thank you. The phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email at talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. Going to Anne calling from Essex, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne.
Oh, good morning. Good day. I'm so glad that we can all be thinking about this together, because it's such an important thing. And when you know that someone cares about you and loves you, it's the most important lifeline for people to keep them having hope and wanting to be alive. And it's just the most important thing. And it's also so important for people to be able to have enough money to have really good food, to grow it themselves or to be able to buy it. And it's just such a shame that so few people can. And the world is so full of such non-food, you know, just cardboard shelf life kind of thing.
Greg, would you like to respond to Anne?
Boy, and you know what you really talk about is, you know, other than the food, which certainly if affects our state of mind, is connection between people and knowing that you have a place in the world and belong. And I think that's one of the pieces we see for most people who become suicidal, is that sense of being alone, that sense of isolation. And anything that any of us can do, whether that's for our next door neighbor, one of our clients, the people we see on the street and just can engage in with a simple greeting and connection, that increases that sense of connection between two people. And I don't think we can underestimate the power of that as a preventative factor, as a protective factor in anybody's life.
Anne, thank you for your call. We have an email from Ellen. Why isn't the discussion including the link between suicide and concussions? Our young people are very active in sports. It is only recently that concussions have been treated properly. Dr. Panette.
That's true. We are finding more and more research that the brain goes through tremendous biochemical changes and can put people at risk with chronic concussions, repetitive concussions, and we need to pay particular attention to that. And as Jane mentioned when she was speaking earlier about the rapid, constant evolution of the brain changing in children up until the age of approximately 24, it affects the judgment centers of the brain, the frontal portion of the brain, as well as our addiction centers, the nucleus accumbens. And so there is a lot of activity, and that research continues.
Boy, this is all intertwined, isn't it? The functioning of the brain, mental health issues, what's going on, the stressors in everyday life. It's hard to pull one of these elements away from the others, isn't it?
Very much.
All right.
It's complex. That's what we know about suicide. There's a complex overlapping factors that contribute or protect.
That's right, Greg. And this is a comprehensive public health issue. And, you know, the Maine CDC houses the Maine Suicide Prevention Program with multiple partners, including NAMI of Maine. Many of our crisis centers, like Seth's, involved with parents, Veterans Affairs, the public safety, the Department of Labor and Corrections, and the Department of Education. And together, we all work together to try to increase public awareness about suicide prevention and try to reduce the incidence of suicide behaviors amongst all people in Maine.
We are going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Portland Stage, with the Savannah Disputation, a thought-provoking theological comedy through May 18th, portlandstage.org.
Lance Armstrong, Donald Trump, Dear Abby.
The people who we look to for wisdom are often terrible at following their own advice.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The irony of the self-help industry. We'll have that story for you and the numbers from Wall Street as well next time on Marketplace from APM.
Join us for Marketplace this evening at 6:30. MPBN now has a powerful new educational resource for teachers here in Maine, PBS Learning Media. Learning Media is an on-demand media service for educators that provides easy access to a wide range of classroom-ready, curriculum-targeted resources for grades K through 12. Go to mpbn.net for more information and to explore this free educational resource.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Suicide Prevention. With me in the studio, Seth Mativier. He is the manager of the Crisis Line and at Opportunity Alliance, and he is a clinician. Joining us from our Augusta studio, Dr. Sheila Panette, director of the Maine Center for Disease Control, and Greg Marley, who is clinical director with NAMI Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Steve in Waldoboro. He writes, "My son killed himself at age 24, a young man who seemed to have everything going for him. My wife and I were shocked at the lack of resources in Maine. If you have a visible medical problem, you get all kinds of help. But emotional distress, no. We approach doctors and counselors, and they seem to have very little idea what to do other than to prescribe potentially dangerous drugs that can even cause suicidal thinking. A local hospital released our son after only a few days, despite clear signs that he was self-destructive, on a self-destructive path. We made our son's suicide very public in the hope it will help others and help our society be more open about mental illness. Our lives change forever. The heart has scars that can't heal. And Steve, I'm so sorry to hear your story. It was all I could do to make through reading it without crying. But I want Greg and Dr. Panette, both of you, to address this. I don't know what year this was that his son died. But is there still a problem? Are there doctors? Are there medical professionals who don't properly identify and treat the kind of signs that Steve is talking about?
Well, I'm really glad that Steve wrote in. I know Steve. I know this story. And it was an incredible tragedy that his son died. We have a challenge in this society. And one of them is, you know, part of it is a recognition of risk, but part of it is also the right for someone to say yes or no about treatment unless they are clearly and distinctly at imminent risk. It's hard to hold someone in a hospital who is refusing to engage in help seeking and is not acknowledging or they're denying that they're suicidal. And it can be a tragedy when that doesn't happen. And the tragedy is the loss in life and the everyone left behind with the grief and the real deep sense of helplessness and loss about trying to stop a needless death.
Greg, if you know Steve, you know how long ago this was. How long ago was this death?
It was about 6 years ago.
Okay. And Dr. Panette, have things improved since then, do you believe?
Well, you know what? I think this is a constant evolution. First of all, I want to acknowledge the loss of his son. It's very hard. The greatest loss of any parent is the loss of their child. So I want to say I'm sorry for that. We are working constantly, partnering with other people. We have just received a grant in October 2013, which will go through September 2016, bringing resources to the state of Maine where we can partner with NAMI Maine and the tribal communities and the college universities, as well as LGBT community, which also is at risk for suicide. And we're trying to help set up with the Department of Education training, screening, identification of suicide throughout, and trying to get as many people trained as possible to see risk factors and to be able to help counsel people.
Seth, is it important for parents, even if they have children who seem perfectly well adjusted, to talk about this, to say to them, no matter what happens in your life, please don't ever take your own life. Please come to me. Please go to someone. It's never, ever, ever the right choice. Is it important to be proactive? Does it make a difference?
I believe it does, and we in the field do believe it does, to have open, honest conversations with your children about suicide, about other hot topics that are very much of concern, to be able to show them that you're comfortable having that conversation and to invite them to come to you with any issues. And I like what Dr. Panette had said earlier, that if you're not comfortable coming to me, please go to a trusted adult, with somebody that you can confide in and share with them what it is that's going on for you that's troubling you so much.
I know that I live in a family where suicide has been used as a means of escaping pain. And it's something I'm very much concerned about for my son and for his cousins. And we've always, obviously with the work I do, suicide is an open place of conversation. And it's been heartening to know that my son, who's now 20, has come forward several times to talk about friends that he's had concern with and saying, Dad, what should we do? So having that open conversation is vital.
I have an email from Dan in Portland. An observation: we often talk of warning signs, and this is important, but it is as important to note that sometimes the warning signs are very subtle or not typical. Some people don't show the signs we're conditioned to look for. teens especially can make it difficult as they struggle already with their own biological changes that can give misleading cues. I've lost two teens close to me, a 19-year-old and a 13-year-old. Neither left notes. Neither gave obvious warning signs in advance. And in both cases, only in hindsight could the smallest hints of a problem be found, though at the time they did not suggest suicide was the outcome. Rather, it seemed like a usual day-to-day struggles of a teenage boy. And writes, thank you for your time on this important topic. Dr. Panette, would you like to address this how subtle the signs can be and how scary that is for parents and other loved ones of a teenager?
That's exactly right. You know, our children can be very impulsive, and while suicide can't always be prevented, we certainly think training people and educating people is worth trying. And, you know, suicide events and crisis can be very momentary. They can be very fleeting and short, and unfortunately, we cannot prevent all suicide, but we can certainly put a good college effort in terms of trying and educating people.
Headed to David in Lincolnville. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Several years ago here in Lincolnville, there were a couple of kids who had committed suicide, and our youngest son knew both of them. But there were a few suicides that had some other ones as well that had happened in this area. And so I knew a couple of the kids. And it really took everybody completely by surprise. I mean, it just blew everybody away. And through our elementary school, they sponsored a group to come in just to help. It's called Caring Good Choices. And so my wife and I decided to participate in it with our youngest son. And it was one of the most educational, worthwhile activities that I think we had done in our experience with the elementary and middle school. And I felt, both of us felt like it was underattended, and that it's something that I think most parents should just attend at some point when they have children who are in the school system. It was an incredibly positive experience going through this. It wasn't depressing. And the reality is that most parents really don't have the tools to know how to deal with the complexities of our culture, peer pressures that the kids are going through. I mean, it's a minefield out there psychologically for these kids. And so, you know, helping to navigate, having the tools to help them navigate and to be able to communicate with them is incredibly important. And I just can't speak highly enough of
David. Can you do something for me? Can you go on the Maine Calling Facebook page and put any information you have about Caring Good Choices so anybody listening might be able to find out more about that program?
Okay, Jennifer, let me talk.
And that's really all I had to say. So I'll let you take it from there. And again for this program.
Okay, Greg.
Yeah, the program is called Guiding Good Choices, uh-huh. And the ones in the Lincolnville, Camden, Rockport area are sponsored by a wonderful organization called the Five Town Communities That Care, and they are dedicated to helping build protective factors and options and choices and hope in youth, particularly youth at risk. And that's a program for parents of preteens and teens about, you know, family skills, communication, family management. It is a wonderful program, and I know that the Five Towns Communities of Care is working to try and provide another round of that course. I've actually led or co-led a couple of those sessions. They're wonderful. It's a wonderful course.
Well, that said, Jennifer, I think that knowledge is empowering, and that is the cornerstone of the Maine Suicide Prevention Program, is to talk face-to-face with people, help to dispel myths, and to educate people more and more about risk and how we can cope.
Going to Jean in Augusta. Hi, Jean. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm actually not from here, so I'll have to find my resources when I leave. I'm here on business. But I'm calling about, I guess my question is sort of about when to consider medication. So I have a teenager who opened up to us finally in December and said, if he was having way more suicidal thoughts than he was comfortable with, and we did talk therapy, and we've been to his pediatrician, and discussed it, and he keeps holding off on wanting to try medication. As someone said, it's really subtle, you know, is he being a teenager or what's going on, because he seems to do better and then he backslides. And so he's kind of looking to us, and I have no idea.
Oh, Jean, so, I'm sorry.
I'm hearing everything, you know, about looking for the signs before. We're in the middle of it. What do you do?
Seth, do you want to respond to Jean?
Sure. Yeah, you know, and you mentioned, Jean, that you feel like you're in the middle of it. And certainly when we're concerned about a loved one that is in crisis or struggling to the level that your son is, those who love and care about the individual are in crisis as well. What state are you in, Jean?
Massachusetts.
And what I would say, are you familiar with 211? Because 211 is an organization that would be in states other than just Maine, also in the U.S.
Okay.
So, 211, I believe, is a resource that would be available for you down there for various health and human services that might be able to get your son some services. Crisis services would also be available in the state of Massachusetts as well.
Uh-huh.
So that might be a good support for you. I don't know. Is NAMI down there as well, Greg?
Yeah, NAMI Massachusetts is active.
Okay.
I'm really, you know, it sounds like, Jean, that your child is looking to you for leadership here. So it may not be that one
relationship, but
and it's not that there's one specific answer that's the right one, medication, therapy, but something has to be done. You gotta, you know, look at your options and say, we have to choose one or choose a couple of these. We can't do nothing and just see what happens.
I agree
well,
with that, Greg.
Therapy. Yeah. He's been doing that for months. So that's kind of my question. Like, if it's not seeming better, does that mean we should try medication too?
You know, this is Dr. Panette. You know, I can hear the fear in your voice, and I know you're scared. And I think that, you know, you definitely have to engage with your providers and your counselors, and there's going to be a chance time when you're going to decide, and it's probably now, if things aren't working, that you probably should enter into a conversation about the risk and benefits and side effects of medication. And, you know, I think it's worth it to try, but it may not work. And you have to understand that it's a constant evolution, and you may not find that even one drug will help, but it's worth the try, because I think if something happened, you might be regretting that you never at least tried.
Well, thank you, Jean, for your call, and good luck to you and to your son. I really appreciate it. We have a very quick email question. Are people who are at risk more likely to make an attempt at certain times of the year?
Mm. Suicide rates tend to peak during the warmer months. For young people in Maine, it tends to be, you know, May, June, July, and that they are actually the lowest in the middle of winter. And living in Maine, you might think, well, that's doesn't make sense.
Counterintuitive, right.
Yeah. But in March, if you're a little bit desperate and despondent and squirrely and feeling cabin fever, you've got a lot of company. If you're still feeling that way in May and June, and everybody else is moving forward and loving life, then you may have the energy to act on that despondency. So it's warmer months where there's a higher rates, and that's in Maine as well as across the country.
We have a Facebook post from Marilyn. While correlation is not causation, there has been an increase in veteran suicides across the country, and Maine has a high percentage of veterans in our population. Could this be increasing to our increased rate of suicide, Dr. Panette?
Yeah, we are concerned about our vets, especially with PTSD and coming home with depression and all sorts of disabilities, and so we are concerned about that, and those are the groups that we are working with as well.
We just have a little tiny bit of time left. I want, Seth, if you would please give us the phone number again for the crisis hotline. We'll also put this on our Facebook page. And any final thoughts you have about for someone who may be listening and may be concerned about a loved one?
The number again is 1-888-568-1112. And dialing that number will route you to the nearest crisis response center in your area, anywhere in the state. In terms of final thoughts, if you're concerned about a loved one, please just give us a call. I know there's a lot of hesitation that is out there for individuals that's experienced when you don't feel like you're in crisis or your situation is acute enough to rise to the level of calling the number. But please, please just move beyond that and give us a call. We can explore with you what's going on. We have trained mental health rehabilitation specialists to answer the calls, and they'll be happy to listen to you and hear you out and help you come up with some options to provide some support and service to your
loved ones.
So
even though the name is the Crisis Hotline, even if you just have questions, you can call.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Dr. Panette, Greg, Seth, thank you all for joining us today. Sheila Panette, the director of the Maine Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Greg Marley, clinical director at NAMI Maine. And Seth Mativier, he is manager of the Crisis Line at Opportunity Alliance and a clinician working in community mental health and in private practice. Today's program was produced by our volunteer, Lucas Randall Owens, and by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board, and we had additional help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast, by visiting mpbn.net/mainecalling. You can also find our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow on the program, tomorrow is Veto Day in Augusta. Join host Keith Shortall for a roundup of the latest news out of the State House. We'll also hear about the latest in the race for Maine's 2nd District Congressional seat. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.